Less than 24 hours after Sister Michelle Lewis was found stabbed to death in a Miami convent, investigators were successfully closing out the search for her killer.
Mikhailo Kofel, a teenage monk in training, admitted how he got drunk and entered her bedroom in the dead of night, then stabbed her more than 90 times.
As the young Ukrainian sat in the homicide department, taking police step by step through his crime, an offer for Mikhailo came in from the lobby.
Well, I was being interviewed by the detectives. One of the detectives interrupted us and says, before you say anything else, the police are here and they're sending the lawyer to represent you. And I said, I decline. I said, I don't want their lawyer. I don't want anything to do with them.
He turned down that lawyer because after confessing to the murder, Mikhailo also alleged that those same priests, Father Abbot Gregory Wendt and Father Damien Gibault, both sexually abused him.
A few hours after refusing the lawyer, Mikhailo was taken into custody. Without the priest's attorney, he was now on his own in Dade County Jail. He knew nothing about the judicial system or what was going to happen to him next.
Feeling alone and scared, he reached out to the only family he had since arriving in Miami almost 5 years earlier, the same priest from Holy Cross. But he would find no comfort on the other end.
So they gave this free phone call. So I didn't know anybody. You know, I couldn't call nobody. So of course I was scared. And so I just called Wendt. I remember calling Wendt. You know, it was really just this cold conversation. You know, I could tell that he was really, really angry. I tried to find out what's going to happen next or something like that. He said something like, do you realize that there's a good possibility you're going to be executed?
Mikhailo hung up the phone feeling more solitary than he had before. That short call would be the last time he ever spoke to Father Abbot Wendt or anyone from the monastic family at Holy Cross ever again. I'm Paula Barros.
And I'm Melanie Bartley.
And this is Sacred Scandal.
Well, the young man that committed the murder was in my Spanish class. Very distant, very, you know, just odd, not a part of anything. It was very sad. You could tell that he was very sad.
With Mikhailo, he was weird. To us, he was just an oddball. He was always an oddball. He was strange. He walked strange. He came from somewhere else, and he behaved like he was from somewhere else.
I was a teenager at the time, and, you know, I was just, you know, people weren't fitting in, and of course he couldn't, you know, as years went by, I got more and more disillusioned.
When Melanie and I started trying to tell the story of Holy Cross Academy more than 15 years ago, we knew we needed to talk with the one person at the center of everything, Mikhailo Kofel. Before the murder, he was just a quiet, little, skinny kid in black clothes to me, a boy who sometimes I laughed with when we were paired up to struggle through broken conversations in French class. But other than knowing he was from Ukraine and that he said he was sexually abused by the priests, I really didn't know all that much about him. And part of me was always curious about why he killed Sister Michelle. And I couldn't get my head around how a kid I sat next to in class could commit such a terrible, violent crime. So a few years after I graduated from Holy Cross, Melanie and I reached out to Mikhailo in hopes of someday getting those answers.
It all started with a letter.
And I think the first letter we wrote to him, just first to get to know him, right? Because we were like, let's see. And then we ended up just...
And then he was like, you are the first, like, this is the first letter I've gotten in years.
5 years, 5 years.
It had been, I mean, this was like 2006 or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 5 years.
So yeah, 5 years.
And then he remembered everything. He remembered you were an actress, Paula, and you sat next to me in French. And I remember your plays and your, remember?
Yeah.
And then I don't, for a while, we were just getting to know him for like letters and letters.
And remember our moms, like the first time when we started getting letters from prison?
Oh my God.
They were like,
what?
Why does this murderer have our address?
And who else has our address? yeah.
After sending letters back and forth, we finally decided to make a trip about 90 minutes north of Miami to visit him in prison.
That first visit to Indian Town, Florida, oh my when God. He was at Martin Correctional, that was the most nervous I've ever been.
We would go, we would take like our weekend trips and stay at a hotel in Stewart.
How did we
remember?
Yeah, how did we have money for that?
During that visit, he stopped being Mihailo and he asked us to call him Mike, the name he started using while in prison. It's a name he told us he wanted to be called when still in school, but the priest wouldn't let him.
After that, driving up to Indian Town to see Mike became something we did maybe every few months. He was nervous and reserved at first, but over time, he opened up. We got to know more about his life and his story during each visit.
Until, that is, we got banned from the prison. So being young and amateurs, we may have broken one of the cardinal rules of correctional facilities, which is, of course, don't film or take pictures of the actual prison. And that is exactly what we had our camera person do one time while we were inside.
We never got permission to film an interview with Mike and thought it would be cool to get this really artsy time lapse of the clouds rolling over the roof of the prison. But when we came out, police and security were all over our camera guy. They surrounded us and our car. They thought we were trying to help break Mike out of prison. We were horrified.
Once things calmed down, they made us delete all the footage right then and there. We were banned from Mihailo's visitor list and the prison altogether.
And because of our mistake, things weren't going well on the inside either.
But I want to know your side. Like, what happened to you after?
Oh, yeah, yes. So they called my name. Yeah, they took me to a room. Of course, they strip searched me. And then they put me in handcuffs. I'm like, what the hell is going on? They wouldn't tell me. So, yeah, they took me to confinement. Yeah. And then I remember the next day, a classification officer came around. And she said, soon you're going to be transferred to another prison.
So oh, I was my really, God. Yeah, oh, so my that, God.
So really bad. Yeah, I had this really bad feeling. It really, like.
Were you upset at us?
Oh, no, of course not. You didn't know. You definitely didn't know. And you didn't know the rules. Yeah.
We scrambled over the next few days. We submitted an apology to the warden with a packet of information and even a DVD of the movie trailer. We hoped explaining our project would help get him out of the confinement area.
After 8 days, Mike was sent back to his regular block. We felt horrible after the whole thing. Losing direct contact with him is one of the things that really stopped us from working on our documentary. But worse than that, Paolo and I also knew that we were the only people who ever came to see him.
We started to feel the sense of compassion for him, like we were the only people in his life. And after so many visits, we felt like we couldn't just disappear on him. Since getting banned all of those years ago, both of us have continued to keep in touch, through snail mail and the phone at first, and now, in a different time, through lots of email and sometimes videograms.
Mike is very much a part of our lives. And getting his perspective on what happened to him at Holy Cross and what he witnessed there kept us motivated to tell his story. And this year, we actually started recording those calls as he walked us through everything that happened.
Hello, this is a prepaid call from
an inmate at a Florida Department of Corrections institution.
Hello, Melanie. Hey, it's me again.
Hi, yes, I'm not sure what happened.
And these conversations aren't easy. Our phone calls are capped at 30 minutes. So sometimes we just start getting really into talking about something only to be interrupted by a 1 minute warning.
You have 1 minute remaining.
We have 1 minute remaining.
Okay, Mel.
And after that, we can't even jump back into the conversation straight away because we have to wait another 30 minutes between calls. Sometimes it can take days to even finish a single conversation.
So I guess I'll call you tomorrow.
On the inside for Mike, there's more to worry about. We talk about some really personal and sensitive stuff on these calls. Things you might not want just anyone to hear.
I wish we had more privacy.
He talks to us from a bank of shared phones, where the next person over can hear your every word.
In the morning, if it's quiet, it's probably really, really hard.
We try talking early in the day, which is better for recording because there's less noise from the block. But morning calls make Mike uncomfortable. In the empty hallways, his voice echoes through the quiet for everyone to hear. So a lot of the time, we talk later in the day when the sounds of daily life in prison mute his words to other inmates.
Thank you for using Global Tellink.
Oh, no.
Before we go any further, yes, Mike is a confessed murderer who brutally stabbed someone to death. But the person we've gotten to know over the years is more complicated than that single act. We'd like you to get to know Mike in the way we have. So for the rest of this episode, we'll be sharing some of our conversations with him to explain how a boy from a rural mountain village in Ukraine and others like him found themselves at a monastery in the suburbs of Miami. That story after a break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Sacred Scandal. Mihailo Kofel's story starts in the early 1980s, far from the beaches of Miami. It starts far from any beach, really. His story begins in one of the most inland parts of Europe, a region of Ukraine in the Carpathian Mountains called Zakarpattia or Transcarpathia.
It's an area that used to be part of the Kingdom of Hungary and then Czechoslovakia, but it was absorbed into the Soviet Union during the Red Army's occupation at the end of World War II. Today, it sits on the western edge of Ukraine. Zakarpattia is a small state whose complex history puts it on the border of four other countries: Romania, Hungary, Slovakia, and Poland.
About a two-mile hike from the Polish border sits Verkhobina Bystra, the village where Mike was raised.
The town has about 1,000 people, I'd say, about 200 or so houses. And winters were really brutal. October is pretty much started to snow.
Wow, that's really early in the year for snow.
And really, the snow stays in the mountains, I remember, until May. I remember.
Mike lived through these endless winters with his parents, Maria and Yuri. The Kofels owned a small, simple house that they shared with his grandparents. Small and simple in that there were not enough rooms for Mike to have his own space. Up until he left, he shared a bed with his parents. Village life in Ukraine of the 1980s was very much like it had been 100 years before. The home was warmed by a wood-burning heater. It had no plumbing until the mid-1990s. The toilet was a simple outhouse in the back. Verkhobina Bystra was a picture of rural life behind the Iron Curtain.
And how did you get around if you had to go to another town?
We just used the bicycle, so just walked, you know. But my father did have a motorcycle with a sidecar.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah,
did you ride in the sidecar?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, I did. But of course, it was also hard to get gasoline at the time. So most of the time, you walk.
What was it like in your town? Did people have money? What kind of work did they do?
Most of them, if not all, people were still doing the farm work. My father did, he was working on the railroad. And still, the whole country was so broke, basically if you were still working, they still wouldn't pay you. They were prolonged, delayed,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, months, all countries. The time was really broke or just corrupt, maybe.
And you said your father worked in the railroad. What about your mom?
Me and my mom, we were working on the fields. Even my father's after work, you sometimes come and start working in the fields. And yeah, during time, I just remember just working, also working a lot. The school ended at like 12 o'clock. And after school, I'll come back, just get dressed and go to, into the fields to work.
How old were you?
7, 8 years old. It's, you know, nothing exceptional. Everybody pretty much worked like that.
Did you like to work?
I didn't mind, but as I remember, sometimes you get tired of it, like, damn, because basically it was like menial work from like 1800s, because, you know, you got your shovel, you got your rake, you know, basically it's those tools from, you know, 1800s. And also in the summer, like, we had no school in the summer, so basically then you had to work the whole day.
Did you ever think about what you wanted to do when you grew up, when you were that age and you were working in the field?
All the kids would just decide, like, they want to do something that your father did. So I was like, oh, I guess I'll go work on a railroad. And I really wasn't sure, you know. And everything was really uncertain because everything was just in turmoil, you know, and just a lot of hard times.
And things got worse in 1991 when the Soviet Union dissolved. The economy collapsed, and the entire country started to change as trade restrictions were lifted.
I grew up, well, my earliest memories being during the time the Soviet Union broke up. Everybody broke, the whole shelves were empty, everything just, like you see, then everything just started coming in. The whole market opened up, you know, you got products from Europe coming in, from America, everything, the movies, entertainment, so totally different.
What kind of movies and TV shows were you watching?
Oh, you know, the usual, those classics, American movies, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone. They had this small movie theater. Everybody just tried to cram in, get there. And so we had a little bit of money, and remember, we bought a TV, like we had like one of the first color TV. So it was like a big thing. And some of my friends said, oh, man, you got a color TV. It's like early 90s.
Like in general, like, would you say you had a happy childhood?
Some parts, yes. A lot of parts, no. Sometimes hanging out, playing soccer, that was kind of fun. But growing up, yeah, there were a lot of bad parts.
And the bad parts, Mike says, didn't just have to do with the struggles of his country's changing economy. Mike was also dealing with problems inside his home.
Let's talk a little bit about your family.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe your dad? Anything you can think of when you think of him?
Okay. I just remember growing up, just my first memories, my father was already drinking. He was an alcoholic, you know, but he was also working, of course, in the railroad. But you're not, of course, you're not supposed to be drinking when you're, of course, driving the train.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember, yeah, before he went to work, he would, like, spray his mouth, whatever. Then I asked my mom if she can smell any alcohol on him. And, yeah, of course, he would hit my mother.
So he was violent towards your mom?
Yeah, he would get violent.
How old do you remember when you were, how old you were when you started witnessing that?
Oh, I was really young. I was maybe 5, 4. I remember being, you know, I just remember that my mother sometimes be like scared because, you know, she would hear that motorcycle and late at night because she knew that he'd be usually drinking.
How did that make you feel?
Of course, nervous and scared. But when he was not drinking, like, he was like normal, you know. Eventually, he had an accident. He would crash his motorcycle. So I remember he took him to the hospital. He had a broken leg. So he spent some time in the hospital. But after he recovered, he still continued to drink.
When he would get violent, when he was drunk, did you or your mom or anybody ever call the police?
No, our town didn't have no police station. No. Of course, we didn't have no phones either.
As Yuri's drinking grew worse over the years, he became more physically abusive towards Mike and his mother. The violence was like a dark cloud over his childhood, which overshadowed any happy memories the family shared. But there was one of his father's drunken outbursts that Mike could not forget. And it's the moment he described to police after he confessed to killing Sister Michelle. Mike told detectives that one night, when he was about 12 or 13, Yuri came home after he and his mother had gone to sleep. Mike said he woke up to feel his dad's hands and body on him, drunkenly touching Mike in a sexual way.
did you ever get a sense that your dad was, like, he understood that he had a drinking problem? And did he ever, like, apologize? Did he ever say, like, I'm going to stop drinking or I'm going to get better or anything like that?
No. I don't remember him saying that at all. But, you know, but basically I had mixed emotions back then because I hated him because he was keep on drinking, hating my mother, and so it always was, and but also, you know, part of me, of course still love him because of my father, and we had good times. I just remember just him being mean, violent, just hitting my mother, and me just also like crying, trying to defend my mother, and it's just, I remember telling my mother, oh, let's just get out of here, just leave, go for the city, and
wow. I said, no. So you were telling your mom that you should leave your dad.
Yeah, you know, at that time I was really heartbroken, so I told her to leave, and of course she was crying, and she said they really didn't have no place to go.
Though Mike and his mom couldn't leave their home together, he would one day be offered his own way out. That's coming up after a break.
Welcome back to Sacred Scandal. I'm Melanie Bartley.
And I'm Paula Barros. One of the ways Mike and his mom, Maria, dealt with the trauma of Yuri's drinking was through their faith as Greek Catholics. Transcarpathia is where Greek or Byzantine Catholicism began in the 17th century. But because of the church's affiliation with the Pope, Greek Catholics in the region were persecuted by the Soviet Union. Some leaders were imprisoned as suspected spies of Rome, and their denomination was forced to merge into the Russian Orthodox Church.
Well, I remember, during time, because even in my town, like, the teachers were, like, discouraged from going to church. But it was everything, so when you broke out, you know, everything got more freedom.
But Greek Catholics like Mihailo and his mom continued to meet and pray in secret or gather in rural churches. After the Soviet Union dissolved, things changed.
We were a Greek Catholic. It was a forbidden religious in whole Ukraine. And we were like praying at houses and gathering together. And even my schoolmates didn't know that we have prayers at home. And but Greek Catholic, we were like always hiding.
This is Ilya Herzog. He was once a monastic candidate at Holy Cross, too, though he arrived a few years after Mike and left before Sister Michelle's murder. We reached out to a number of former monastic candidates because we were curious to know about how they got to Miami and learn about their lives at Holy Cross. Of those we heard back from, Ilya was the only one willing to speak with us at all. These days, Ilya lives in Ukraine, he's married, has a family, and runs a business. But back in the 1990s, both Mike and Ilya were in similar places, living in small, rural Transcarpathian villages of about 1,000 people. And faith played a large part in each of their lives. For Mike, by the time he turned 13, he was already planning to spend the rest of his life living as a monk, serving a monastery.
Even before going to America and say, oh, I want to be monk for the rest of my life. I want to be a monk in Ukraine, and I was really, really into it. That was my intention, spend my whole life being a monk.
And for Ilya, the end of restrictions around his faith also moved him in the direction of monastic life.
When you grow up 10 years praying and waiting for your church to become a free church and build your churches and to be monk, it was okay for me, and especially for my parents. They were really glad, but didn't push me in any way.
At the same time, Ukraine was undergoing a massive economic shift as the now independent country found its way in the wake of the Soviet Union's demise. The new nation was also becoming more open to Western countries. And it's at this point that a priest from Miami appeared in Transcarpathia, searching for devout Catholic boys like Mike and Ilya.
When was the first time that you found out about Holy Cross and went and that these priests were looking for monastic candidates? Who told you about them?
The first time that I heard about Father Wen and Father Gibault was from our local priest in Ukraine, who was going to my town on Sundays and doing the mass. And his name was Yuri Sabo. At the time, on Sundays, I was reading from the gospel during mass. And on Saturdays, he was teaching me about the Bible and Catholic religion in general. So at one time, he told me all about Father Wen and if I was interested of going to United States.
And do you remember how he described them, like what he told you about them?
So Father Sabo said, you know, these are good people, you know, Father Wen is good, so of course we trust the priest, you know, so, and he said that if I was interested, that I would go to this house in Ukraine, and this was like a test, he would test us, ask questions, so I said yes.
Mihailo said yes to what he thought would be a great opportunity to escape a violent and chaotic home. His own priest, Father Sabov, was kind of a mentor, and he was finding more reasons to spend time at the church, to study with the priest, or to attend religious festivals. So the offer to join an American monastery was exciting. On top of joining the monastery, the boys were also told that they would have the opportunity to study at the newly built Holy Cross Academy. With the permission of their parents, those interested in joining would leave home for a trial run of what life at the monastery would be like. It was kind of like a reality TV show where all of the contestants arrive at a house and the last ones standing win.
Okay, at the beginning, we were the first ones ever. So at the time, they just rented this house like in the woods, in this town called Hust. Once the date came to go, I remember being really nervous. I was nervous of going and was meeting, you know, this American priest. So we went to the main city, which was Uzhhorod. And once there, Father Wen got out from the van. I remember this tall guy dressed in black and big and beard.
When you saw him the first time, what did you think?
I was really nervous. I think he might have like hugged me or something. I think so. So anyway, well, I said goodbye to my mother and I got inside the van. So we drove there and eventually there were about, I'd say, 7 or 8 of us inside the house. That was in the summer of 96 in July.
When Ilya found out about Holy Cross a few years later, the experience was similar. A local priest who met the American and knew he was looking for boys to become monks introduced Ilya to the idea of joining the monastery in Miami. Ilya never met Wen until he joined the training center. Also, by the time he signed on, Wen moved things from the rented cabin in the woods to a newly built country house made specifically to be used as a year-round monastic training and recruiting center. It was staffed by local people, and Wen would visit during the year. Ilya joined the center with about 9 other boys, including his cousin, Vasil.
Yes, and we went there and for this preparation center together. We were driving home back and forth, always together, so.
What was your first impression of Father Abbott?
The impression of Father Wen, it's like when you know some person, everybody was saying who is he and how is he, and when I saw him, it was for me like a pope, because we were prepared for this. We were told that it's a big authority and he is almost holy man, and you see, and you have to obey, and he's the first person in monastery.
So describe a little bit what the process was like for you.
Yeah, and we stayed here in Uzhhorod, learning, studying, getting ready for church, for singing and English, because before I learned German, so English for me was like something new, totally. And we were praying, and we had a schedule every day, the same time. We were doing the same things, or to be prepared for monk life like this.
Aside from living like monks at the training center, Mike told us that Wendt also interviewed the potential candidates regularly through an interpreter. Father Wendt asked questions about their faith and families to figure out who would be best suited for a life at Holy Cross.
Did he ask you any questions about your relationship with your father? Like, did you tell him about your father's drinking problem and all of that? Do you remember that?
Oh, no, you know, of course it's something I withheld, you know. I don't want to say, you know, I wasn't, you know, feeling comfortable telling that, you know. You know, basically, you know, I said, you know, I'm, you know, everything's fine, you know. I'm, you know, my parents are fine. I'm...
So you were trying to get selected. You were basically saying the things you knew he wanted to hear to get selected.
Oh, yeah, yeah. At the time, I just wanted to get away from my town, from my father, and go to America. No, looking back, yeah, I was really, you know, really emotional on different aspects of things and depressed. And it was a really, really difficult time at the time.
By the end of July, most of the boys quit or were asked to leave the house in the woods. Only Mihailo and two other boys passed the test. One of them was Petro Tarenta, the monk who would one day find Sister Michelle's body. Next, they were sent alone on a day-long train journey to Kiev, Ukraine's capital city, to get their visas to study in the United States. Petro was approved that day. Mike was told to make another long trip home and return with his parents. And the third boy never got the visa. Mike and Petro would be the first monastic candidates at Holy Cross.
What was the criteria, do you think, that Wendt was using when he started narrowing down? And why did you, Petro, and this other kid stay and the other kids leave?
Now thinking back, I know why. He was looking at the guys that were like really humble, really obedient, really, you know, also religious. The boys whom he could easily control, manipulate, whom they could easily brainwash. Yeah, so that was the main thing.
As the end of summer 1996 approached, and with a new school year around the corner, the teenagers would need to leave almost immediately in order to have enough time to get settled in. But Mike, who was now 14, knew he was leaving a lot of worries behind in Ukraine, especially with his dad.
He was dead drunk. The last day before I went to the United States, he was dead drunk.
What do you mean dead drunk?
He was just passed out from drinking. And I just, I think I said like goodbye, Dad, and I remember saying that, and then I left.
And when you said goodbye, what did he say? Do you remember?
No, he didn't. He didn't. He might have said something incoherent, you know. By the time, he was really drinking bad.
How did that make you feel when you were leaving and your dad was passed out drunk? Like,
oh yeah, I was of course heartbroken. Most of the time. Even after, of course, left, because I was still worrying about my mother, just how is she doing. And of course, I also worried about him because he was drinking and he was going to work on this big train. This dangerous work, you know?
After that hard goodbye, Maria Kofel would take her son into the city. From there, he'd get on a van to Slovakia, followed by a flight to the Czech Republic, a flight to New Jersey, and then finally, he'd make his way to his new home in Miami, Florida. For Ilya Herzog, the path to Miami was different. After almost 2 years of preparing, Ilya was finally approved for a visa to study at Holy Cross Academy. His cousin Vasil was able to go a year before him. When the cousins were reunited in Miami, Ilya noticed something was off. The pair grew up together and were close in Ukraine, But during this year in Miami, Vasil became distant.
When I came to USA, I had a little contact with Vasil. So we didn't talk. We talked about some things, but Vasil was rather, he didn't like to talk a lot. He wanted to be a monk more than anyone who was there. And we were allowed to speak Ukraine between us, but Vasil almost didn't talk Ukrainian, only English.
Did Vasil change at all in your eyes?
I wouldn't say that he changed. He became more close.
But Vasil wasn't the only monastic candidate who Ilya saw being closed off like this. He said that he and the other boys usually talked and studied together in a common area of their house when they weren't in school. But Ilya noticed that sometimes Mihailo's attitude would change and he didn't want to be a part of the group. Ilya says that usually seemed to happen after Father Damien would ask to speak with Mike privately in his room.
Sometimes Mihailo went to the Damien's room, and after 1 hour or 2 hours staying there, came in out and didn't talk to anybody, going directly to his room and staying there till the morning. So it was always like this with Father Damien and Mihailo.
So no other monks would ever go into Damien's room for 2 hours like that? It was only Mihailo?
Not at all. I didn't see anybody else to go there. Even Petro didn't go there.
And they would close the door behind them?
I don't remember. Maybe yes, but I didn't see anybody.
As a regular student at Holy Cross Academy, I always thought the monastic candidates were a little weird and quiet just because they had to be. But hearing things like this from Ilya made me realize that even though we were on campus every day, we really had no idea what was going on behind the walls of that monastery. And after talking to Mike for all these years, what we found out has shocked us. So next time on Sacred Scandal, we're going to take a look at what life was like on the campus of Holy Cross when no one was looking. Sacred Scandal is a production of Exile Content Studio in partnership with iHeartRadio's My Cultura podcast network. Sacred Scandal was created and produced by Melanie Bartley and me, Paula Barros. Our senior producer is Dennis Funk of Written in Air. The executive producers are Rose Reed and Nando Villa. Our production assistant is Imani Leonard. The show is fact-checked by Kimberly Winston. Original music was composed by Patrick Hart. And special thanks on this episode to Travis Roig. If you'd like to reach out, email us at hello@sacredscandalpodcast.com. And you can follow us on Instagram @sacredscandal.